back at least 8 years. Larry Miller in London reports this is a record fine for the pharmaceutical industry.
GlaxoSmithKline says the settlement covers both civil and criminal liabilities. U.S. investigations centered on the company's sales, marketing, and compliance procedures of 9 drugs, including its controversial diabetes drug Avandia. Among the allegations, that the company marketed some drugs illegally and defrauded the Medicaid program. The investigation also focused on how Glaxo represented to the FDA and to doctors the risk of suicide for those taking one of its drugs. There are also allegations over how sales bonuses were targeted. The company says its procedures have now changed. The fine will be paid out of existing cash reserves. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
And I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections and celebrating National Adoption Month at aecf.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
The Wampanoag Nation saved the Pilgrims from starvation and lived to regret it. We Still Live Here, our next community cinema, tells the story of linguist Jesse Littledoe reviving the Wampanoag language more than a century after the last native speaker died. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, November 8th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I'm sorry that it doesn't look like we're going to be able to do the show that we have set up for this morning to talk with Siddhartha Deb about his book, The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. We will see if we can get that show rescheduled for another day. I think that you will enjoy the conversation. In the meantime, we'll go to the Focus archives for one of our past programs. So for this hour, we'll be not taking calls, but do keep in mind that we will be here live, hour number 2, with our regular monthly computer show. So whatever computer questions you have, Celeste Quinn will be hosting. That will be hour number 2. But again, for hour number 1, this is an archive. Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Many people will know Clarence Darrow as the lawyer who defended a man named John Scopes. He was charged with teaching evolution in a Tennessee public school in 1925. Our guest for this hour of Focus, historian Andrew Kirsten, says that Darrow's life and work still have meaning. He says, in fact, we are living in a period when civil rights are being challenged and the middle class is struggling. Darrow, he says, lived through a very similar period and fought through that time for the interests of the average person. This morning, we will review the life of one of America's most famous attorneys. And our guest is Andrew Kirsten. He's professor of history at University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and has authored a recently published biography of Darrow. And the title of the book is Clarence Darrow, American Iconoclast, and it's published by Hill and Wang. And Professor Kirsten, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm sure when people hear the name Clarence Darrow, they think, oh, I know he was a famous lawyer, and will probably think of the Scopes trial, although I would imagine when people hear Darrow, perhaps what they picture in their mind is Spencer Tracy,
right,
who played a character based on Darrow in the film version of Inherit the Wind.
Which was my favorite movie.
Well, it's a great movie, and it's a great performance, great performances all around in that film, which was,
right,
I guess, rather loosely based on the Scopes trial. But, you know, so they're not going to picture the real man, but I guess the important point to make particularly is that Darrow, certainly in his time, was very famous, was a very well-known American. I imagine, though, also opinion about him was rather polarized. There were probably people who thought he was a great hero and probably people who thought he was a great threat to the American way of life.
Well, you're right on both accounts. Darrow was enormously popular, not only for the cases, but also for his opinions in American politics. And so when things would come up, people would look to Darrow to find out what he thought about. issues like the New Deal or Teddy Roosevelt. So he really was a figure that drew media towards him. And you're absolutely right. He polarized people. In fact, I think he liked that. I think he liked to, as he might say of the day, get other people's goat. And one of my, I was kind of surprised to find that Darrow still polarizes lots of people. Giving talks about Darrow, I have found that some members of the audience are still angry with him about this or that or the other thing, while other members of the audience still revere him as sort of a patron saint of American democracy.
Yeah. And even though he was certainly known for being basically on the left as far as politics are concerned, that he was difficult to pin down, and he also had a way of making, of finding ways to make everybody mad. So there were times when he certainly, I mean, certainly the people in big business thought that he was their enemy, but there also were times when people on the political left were really angry about things that he did.
Absolutely. And I write in the book that he was dogmatically anti-dogmatic. He didn't like to be pinned down. And it's very hard to figure out exactly if he subscribed to some grand ideology, which I say he did not. And so sometimes you would be surprised, and others would be surprised, at the positions he did take. And sometimes he would, as I've written, flip-flop. So he spent his early life as a pacifist, and then World War I comes around, and he completely goes 180 degrees the other way. And that shocked people who had relied on him as a public opinion maker. It shocked them that he came out so strongly for the war so early.
And he also, surprisingly enough, had some difficulties with Franklin Roosevelt and with the New Deal.
Right. He was not a progressive, though sometimes we call him a progressive. I think you can if you use a little p, progressive. But he was never a member of a sort of a progressive movement. And in fact, there are parts of the progressive movement he was very upset about, like temperance and prohibition. And he was not a New Dealer, though he sympathized with the idea of extending the state to help the most vulnerable members of society. He was suspicious that the early New Deal was actually about something else, creating these large cartels that would create stability while giving rise to oligarchy. And so he went after those cartels.
He certainly is known for a handful of very celebrated cases. At the same time, he was involved in a couple of thousand cases in his career as a lawyer, and so we really don't know about a lot of those, or people wouldn't know about a lot of those. I guess one of the things that really strikes me, though, is the point you make about how, no matter what he was doing, how intensely and personally invested in the outcomes of these cases he was.
You're right. He took on the burden, the individual burden of each case. And I think you can see how it aged him in his face and his demeanor. He believed that his future depended on the resolution of each case. And that was when he first became a lawyer in the 1870s in Ohio. He felt that way. And then he felt that way all the way to the end, his last big case in Hawaii. He felt that way, that the outcome of that case was his outcome, and he personalized each case. I mean, he was the lawyer you wanted if you were in trouble. He took each case, had a special meaning to him.
Talking about his childhood, if you look at his parents and the kind of people that they were, and they were definitely liberals of their time. They were very much opposed to slavery. They were very much in favor of women's rights and women being able to vote. And so I guess one would not be surprised that he would grow up to be the kind of person that he was. I think also at the same time you caution people don't make just a simple connection between his parents and him.
Right. I'd struggled thinking about those early chapters for quite some time, and I went back to one of my favorite books, sort of on a lark, and I was reading The Education of Henry Adams. Mm-hmm. And early on, Henry Adams said something that sort of resonated in my head. And Adams said that his childhood was more atmosphere than influence. In other words, there was something about growing up being an Adams, but it didn't, you know, A didn't directly lead to B, didn't directly lead to C. And I thought maybe the same sort of environment Darrow grew up in, so that he had these free thinker parents. They weren't the most radical free thinkers, but they were free thinkers. His dad was a skeptic, his mom less so. And there is something about that upbringing that gave him a critical eye on society. But I also argue that it doesn't directly lead to the attorney of the damned, because when he becomes an attorney, he doesn't take the cases that you think he would take. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's really only until he moves to Chicago that he becomes radicalized. And I think it's the Haymarket Square affair and the Pullman strike that sort of change Clarence Darrow and allow him to become the Darrow we recognize. So family is important, and they gave him these tools, but he was exceptional in his family that way. If it was some sort of mill that all the kids ran through, you'd expect a lot of attorneys like Darrow, but that didn't happen. In fact, his favorite brother, at the end of his life, they argue about politics. His favorite brother becomes very conservative, and at one point he writes, "I'm not going to write to him anymore because he can't take it." So there's something about Darrow and his move to Chicago that transform him and make him want to become that sort of champion of liberty, justice, and freedom.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Andrew Kirsten. He is professor of history in the Department of Democracy and Justice Studies at University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and is the author of a new biography of Clarence Darrow. It's titled Clarence Darrow, American Iconoclast. Hill and Wang is the publisher. It's out now if you'd like to look at it. Well, as the title suggests, that this is a man who throughout his life seemed to be always the guy who was, if there was some kind of David and Goliath battle to be waged, he was always going to be on the David side.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, it's interesting that early on, when he moved to Chicago, he seemed to be interested in getting involved in politics, and did indeed become part of the circle of the governor of the time, a fellow named John Altgeld. And we have a building here on our campus that's named after him. So people maybe will recognize that name.
Right.
What was his interest in getting involved in state politics?
Well, in state politics, in city politics, and in national politics, he was an icon in Chicago city politics for a long time. He was he tried to be a kingmaker in the Democratic Party, and certainly had tremendous influence on many elections. I think Darrow is best understood as a political animal. As a political, and the book I tried to put him in that frame. And so one of your early questions and comments was, how do you make sense of these 2,000 cases that he had? Well, I'm only making sense basically of the political ones. So, and Darrow used the courtroom for political ends. And for a time, he was very interested in electoral politics, both as a candidate for higher office, but also as a person who influences electoral politics. And I think if we don't sort of grab hold of this aspect of Clarence Darrow, you're not going to understand why his first major job is with the Chicago Northwest Railroad. Here's the attorney for the Adam going to work for the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And he did so because he was John Altgeld's guy inside the corporation. He had a wonderful rapport with some of the rich elite in Chicago and in Illinois, and Altgeld needed that money to run for governor. And so Darrow is really, in this early period, the mentee of John Altgeld, one of the great Illinois governors and great politicians in American history.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting because I'm sure that people would be maybe surprised at that detail, because they think of him as being involved with so many leftist causes and being a defender of labor, of organized labor, and then they would look at the fact that he worked as a corporate lawyer for the railroad, and they might think that somehow just doesn't fit.
Yeah, and so how do you make that fit? And if you look at the politics, and Darrow didn't leave many written records that where he would say, today I joined the Chicago Northwest Railroad so I could do this and work for that. But if you watch where he's moving, you can see how he's developing a political reputation and career. And I argue that went from very early in the 1880s all the way through the 1930s. And that's why when Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s needs someone to review the NRA, the National Recovery Administration, he picks Clarence Darrow. Darrow had been one of those leading luminaries in the Democratic Party for decades, And Roosevelt thought that he could rely on Darrow's left-wing sympathies to get a good review of his main anti-depression agency. Of course, that's not how it turned out, but you can see the calculation that Roosevelt's making. And Darrow thought, and this is another very important point, that the courtroom was just a means to an end. And the end was not only getting his client off or the best resolution possible, but also making a political statement. And so if you look at those cases in the 20s, his cases after World War I involving communists, those are all means to an end about expanding the opportunities and aspirations for average Americans so they can think and talk and do as they need to, as they should do, and as they want to.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone on our line number 4 right here. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks for taking my call. Great show. I have a probably an obscure question, but I just wanted to also comment the movie with Spencer Tracy, of course, with regards to the Scopes trial. Fascinating. Anybody who is not familiar with Darrow makes it very interesting. I've got 2 younger children, and they were just they couldn't believe that at that time the country would make such a big deal out of what seemed really a minor issue, but of course at that time it wasn't a minor issue. My obscure question is, I'm from Chicago, and I was wondering if the guest, if they still celebrate the death of Charles Darrow, Clarence Darrow, at Jackson Park, and if and how that actually came to be. I'm guessing that probably Clarence lived in that area and somebody decided to do this on an annual basis, but I was just curious about that. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
All right. Oh, is that something you know about?
I know a little bit about it, and the answer is yes. Every March, there's a ceremony there to commemorate Clarence Darrow's life. And it's actually, for Darrow aficionados, a pretty big deal. That was Clarence Darrow's favorite spot in the universe. He had a townhouse across the street there, and that had been an area he had frequented for a long time. It was part of the Chicago Fair, and Darrow loved looking out his bay windows at that area. When he died, his wife scattered his ashes on that bridge. And the end of my book here is a little bit instructive. What happens then, after he dies, is that spiritualists come and try to contact Darrow on the bridge. And so Darrow died a skeptic's death, which is Darrow did not believe in an afterlife. And so skeptics often came to the bridge in an attempt to contact Clarence Darrow, who I argue either his ghost is really lazy or, as Darrow would have said, dead is dead.
Maybe, I know we're going a little bit out of order here, but just since, again, this, the caller made the reference to the Scopes trial, the thing about that trial that I think is worth remembering is that it seems that all of the parties that were involved, maybe with the exception of Mr. Scopes, but certainly the town, the lawyers, everybody seemed to have really their own agenda for this. And as far as Darrow is concerned, is he was expecting to lose. Maybe he even wanted to lose, because what he wanted to do was to take this case all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yes. This is another example of a case having a larger political significance. Darrow and Brian were old friends. And one of the things I really like about the movie, Inherit the Wind, is you can they sort of develop that theme, that these were two old friends who now were on the opposite sides of this very important issue. And they'd gone back in time and worked politically since the 1890s, when Darrow helped orchestrate the Chicago Democratic Convention. The point of the film and the point of the case was that there are a lot of different agendas here. And for Darrow, the agenda is to fight what he called, fight against what he called this war on science. Darrow was very worried that there was a movement afoot in the United States to not only attack science and scientific thinking, but the ability of students and teachers to engage in free inquiry. And so for him, the Scopes trial had much larger stakes than the sort of fate of John Scopes and the $100 fine he eventually had levied against him. And so Darrow hoped that this one case would lead to an appeal that would go all the way to the Supreme Court and provide a sort of a moment when he could argue in favor of science and free inquiry. And that didn't happen. And in fact, the legal sort of wrangling of that case, Scopes was found guilty, charged $100. But then as they moved the case through the appeals process, the ruling was overturned at a lower level, and it never came to the Supreme Court. So we still battle over the issues of free inquiry in the classroom and teaching evolution, in large measure because the plan that Darrow and the ACLU had didn't come to fruition. But that's another case of this, a very small case, but it's a means to an end. And the end is fighting for science, fighting for freedom of inquiry.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Andrew Kirsten. He's an historian who teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and we're talking about the life of Clarence Darrow. He writes about that in his new book, American Iconoclast. Well, just I'll again take a step back here because you were talking a little bit earlier about his involvement in politics in Chicago. He worked as for the Northwestern Railroad as a lawyer. But also at that point, we start to see the beginnings, really, of his association with labor. And he apparently was very moved by the Pullman strike, 1894.
Right.
Maybe you could just explain what that strike was all about.
Sure. The Pullman company made luxury passenger cars, and they were very profitable and popular at the end of the 19th century. If you were going to travel in the United States, he wanted a Pullman car. And the cars were made in several places, but one of the main production sites was just south of Chicago at Pullman, Illinois, George Pullman's utopian village for putting these cars together. He treated his workers poorly. And what Darrow knew about this, of course, he had been working for the railroad barons for quite some time. And in 1894, there was a strike in Pullman. And the strike actually shut down the United States rail network. There was a lot of sympathy strikes, and other people laid down their tools to support the workers at Pullman. Against the wishes of John Elkeld, who was governor, Grover Cleveland brought in the National Guard and put down the strike. And as Darrow watched that go down, as the National Guard troops moved in and the yards around Chicago were set afire, he became moved, and he wrote his friend Henry Lloyd, another great Chicagoan, and he said, "Don't you know they're making history very fast, and it's all against liberty and freedom. What can be done?" And what was done is that Darrow had this epiphany that he had to leave his life of luxury — it paid well to work for the Chicago Northwest Railroad — and join the movement of workers who were trying to struggle to be free. And that moment is really the moment that he becomes the attorney of the damned. And he fights for Eugene Debs and the American Railway Union, and it leads to a string of other cases that really, until the First World War, Darrow is the lawyer for the labor movement.
We have a caller, another caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. I wonder if you could comment on what's known as the trial of the century, Big Bill Haywood and the IWW in Idaho and western Montana. There's a documentary out called The Trial of the Century, and arguably it was, and really was more important than really even the Scopes trial, in my opinion. Thank you for taking my question.
All right.
Thank you very much. I agree. That trial, which is somewhat forgotten in American history, was called the Trial of the Century. But in fact, Darrow was on several trials of the century, including the Leopold and Loeb case, which is also called the Trials of the Century. But in 1905, the former governor of Idaho, Frank Stunenberg, was assassinated. And he was assassinated because someone believed he was on the wrong side of a labor conflict. And the men who were arrested were all members of the Western Federation of Miners, including Bill Haywood, but there are some others too. And Darrow came for the defense. And it's an important case for a couple reasons. One, he gets his clients free. They have they lose the case, and it's another great victory for the labor movement. In addition, however, it points then to another case in Darrow's career, the L.A. bombing trial, which happened in 1911. And that case and the Haywood case both are illustrative of the class war. And I mean that in very literal terms. There was a class war, a civil war in American history that followed our war between the North and the South. And it lasted from about 1877 really into the 1920s until the New Deal. And that war pitted capitalists and their managers against workers. And it was a very violent conflict. And there were a lot of deaths, a lot of retribution. And the Studenberg case is a case of that retribution. And Darrow was able to lay out for the jury not only what the stakes of the case, but also how it fit into this overall labor war.
And that, again, that's something that people, unless people are particular students of labor history in the United States, is something that I think a lot of people won't really know.
Exactly. And one of the things in talking to people I find fascinating is that we've forgotten that Clarence Darrow was the lawyer for the labor movement. We remember him, perhaps because of the movies, for other cases, Leopold and Loeb, Scopes. But it was these, he built his career and his reputation against fighting these corporate interests.
You made reference to the Los Angeles Times bombing. This was in 1910,
yep.
And when some union men were accused of planting explosives in the building of the Los Angeles Times newspaper, and it started a fire, and some people were killed. And I think in their defense, the people responsible, or perhaps looking back, it was said that they didn't know there would be people in the building. It was not their intention that anybody be killed.
Right.
And in any case, what was the background for this?
The background is that Los Angeles was one of the battlefronts in this class war. And Los Angeles, unlike San Francisco, Los Angeles was an open shop, anti-union town. And they had the newspaper, which sort of beat the drum of anti-unionism, was the L.A. Times. And a couple of union members, iron workers, thought they were going to get the Times for its anti-labor position. And they packed a bomb in what was known as Ink Alley, between this, where the ink was stored next to the building. And they were going to cause some damage to the building and take the newspaper out of operation for a little while. But I don't know. It's hard to imagine someone putting that bomb there and not thinking that someone might get hurt. But in any case, what happened is that it brought the entire building down, and about two dozen people were killed inside. And as a result, Darrow came for the defense. I mean, it was right on the heels of his victory in the Haywood case, and he comes for the defense, and he realizes that the prosecution has lots of evidence against these guys because they had spies inside the labor movement who are feeding them information and documented witnesses. And so Darrow then does the only thing he can do for his clients, which he arranges a guilty plea, and they are sentenced, instead of to death, they are sentenced to long prison sentences. There are certain members of the labor movement that were very angry with Clarence Darrow for doing that. They either wanted them free or martyrs, it's often said. And one of the people who was very angry with him was Eugene Debs, who wrote a series of sort of scathing letters to Darrow explaining why he opposed Darrow's actions in the case and questioning Darrow's motives, wondering perhaps if Darrow had not been bought off himself. It becomes very important that Darrow is abandoned there by the labor movement because after that trial, Darrow himself is brought up on charges in Los Angeles for jury tampering. And he spends the next 2 years in Los Angeles defending himself, but on his own dime. He did not have the support of the labor movement at that time.
Yeah, that's, again, another one of these cases where through action that he thought was the right action to take, that is that he was, I think, he was trying to prevent these men from being executed,
right.
Was seen by his allies in the labor movement and by Eugene Debs, someone that he previously had defended, that was seen as a betrayal, and they really severed their ties with him.
And they did. And one of the consistencies in Darrow's life from the very beginning when he comes to Chicago to the very end of his life is his animosity and hatred of the death penalty. And he did everything he could to trip that up, to break it apart, to stop it from being enforced. And so he would be very proud, for example, of Illinois, which eliminated the death penalty very recently. Mm-hmm. So he thought it was an unwarranted action by the state. And so in his mind, when he saved the lives of his defendants in Los Angeles, he had won the case. But in the labor movement, it didn't have the intended political results that they wanted, but it had the intended political results and results for his clients that Darrow wanted.
And in this hour of the show, our guest is Andrew Kirsten. He's professor of history in the Department of Democracy and Justice Studies at University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and is the author of the new book, Clarence Darrow, American Iconoclast, published by Hill and Wang. I want to talk some more about the L.A. Times bombing, just because I think that's, you know, that's one of those things that people have really forgotten, a story people have really forgotten. But at the time, this was a huge story. Nationally, in the media, think about the Oklahoma City bombing. Well, this was like the Oklahoma City bombing of the day, and it was huge. Got attention all over the country,
right.
And his involvement also got attention because, as you said, he was accused of attempting to bribe jurors in this trial.
Yeah, and historians and biographers sort of come down on two places whether he did it or whether he probably did it. It's hard to imagine. What happened was, as the settlement for the case was unfolding and they had been talking about a plea deal, some of Clarence Darrow's lieutenants, the people who were doing the groundwork for him in Los Angeles, were arrested trying to bribe a couple jurors. In particular, there was one lieutenant, Bert Franklin. And what made the even the more sort of incredulous is that as the arrest was happening, Darrow was running towards Bert Franklin, waving his hat, telling him to be careful or something. And so why was Darrow at that street corner at that precise moment? It seems highly unlikely that Darrow knew nothing about what was going on in his defense team. And there also were rumors that were in Idaho that, in fact, some of the jurors or some of the witnesses had been bribed. So as his one-time law partner, Edgar Lee Masters, once said, Darrow had a kind of stink about him sometimes, that not everything was quite right. Now, it was never proven that Darrow bribed anyone, and he never admitted to doing that. So I come down on the stance where it might have been possible that he did do that. Alan Dershowitz, famous American lawyer, is very critical of Darrow, assuming that he is guilty. But I think, why would Darrow do that? Why would he bend the rules of legal propriety to do that if he did it? And what I think is that, once again, we have to go back to this idea that the courtroom for Darrow was a means to an end. And he was not very concerned about how proper those means sometimes were, because the end result was these clients of his were either going to live or die, and the end result was a statement, a political statement, in this class war. In fact, when he defended himself, and there were sort of two and a half trials, when he defended himself in Los Angeles, his defense rested on the idea that this is not some sort of legal issue. What's at issue is Darrow as a political thorn in the side of corporate America. And if they could get Darrow convicted and sentenced to a long jail or prison sentence, they would remove that thorn for quite some time. And in that, he's right. He's absolutely right, and was right, that the cases against Darrow were politically motivated. It wasn't because Darrow had hypothetically committed some sin in the courtroom. Rather, this was an attempt for the corporations against him to finally get him.
Mm-hmm. And this, I think you cannot underestimate the toll that his involvement in all of this, the LA Times bombing case, then his defending himself against these accusations, all of this occupied several years of his life. I think he was pretty much broke at the end of it. And as you talked about how you can look at him over time and just see how the work that he did aged him. This really all took a huge toll on him.
It did. On his 80th birthday, a New York Times reporter came to Chicago to visit Clarence Darrow in his study overlooking Jackson Park. And Darrow started the conversation by saying, "Do I look 80? And the reporter answered, "Mr. Darrow, you've always looked 80. He had one of those faces that you could, it was really worn, you know. And But Darrow also, I shied away from this in the book about giving him a diagnosis, but if he were here today, we might label him manic depressive. He had highs that were very high and lows that were very low. And in Los Angeles, it coincided with one of those lows, as you can imagine. And he almost killed himself. He had a gun, and he was going to shoot his head, and he didn't. His girlfriend stopped him from killing himself. But it took a toll on him, both personally and professionally. After those Los Angeles trials, a different Darrow emerges. This was the fulcrum of his political and legal career. He was no less committed to democracy, liberty, and freedom for average Americans. But the cases he took after that were of a different sort. He really, except with a few exceptions, never went back to the labor movement as he had previously.
Mm-hmm. And that was after that you see some of these cases, particularly criminal cases, that he became known for, that we think of, Scopes being one, Leopold and Loeb being another.
Right. So Scopes is a case about the in defense of science. Leopold and Loeb is a death penalty case, and the Ossian Sweet case is about civil rights, which is also in 1925. And that's a case that, once again, here's another theme that runs through Darrow's entire life, is the commitment to civil rights for African Americans. And Darrow believed that this case would advance civil rights, and it did.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left. We do have a caller here who must certainly be listening on the Internet because they're in San Francisco, so we'll get to them on our toll-free line here, line 4. Hello.
Hey, greetings, Illinois. Yes, David. Yeah. Hey, you know, I happened to read a book about Leopold and Loeb a while back, and, of course, Clarence Darrow was their attorney. Mm-hmm. And it's always struck me, you know, he was definitely an honorable guy, and the idea that he would take on Leopold and Loeb were like pronounced depraved murderers that did it for sport, but they were the sons of two of the wealthiest guys in Chicago. And so that Clarence Darrow saved these rich guys' sons, he saved their lives, and still the enmity continued against him. And if I remember right, if people get a chance to read, he gives this impassioned oratory about the death penalty, and that even if these kids are utter creeps and useless ne'er-do-wells, they still deserve, the principle of the Constitution. And, it's a great oratory if you get a chance to read that.
Well, again, I don't know, you want to talk some more about that, Mr. Kirsten. In fact,
sure.
And you know, that again was one of these cases where it would seem that for him the principle was what was at stake, and he was willing to defend these two men who would have been really difficult to defend, I'm sure, because of who they were and what they were alleged to have done, but that really it was all about his really fierce opposition to capital punishment.
Exactly. And, well, some people are upset that the great American attorney also needed to make a living. And so that bothered him. But here's a case in his backyard that bothered him on two levels. One is they were tried in the newspapers, they were convicted in the newspapers, and they were sentenced to death in the newspapers. And it angered Darrow that the legal process in America was so very public. And it was true. These were two boys that they lived in the laps of luxury. One of the boys, his father was a shipping and box magnet, and the other boy, his dad was a vice president at Sears Roebuck. They were very wealthy, and it's unimaginable that people who have no care in the world could have done something like this. But the instant that the press and the prosecutor in Chicago decided that these boys' lives were worth nothing and that they should be executed, that's what really rubbed Darrow the wrong way. And it also highlights another thing about Darrow, and he shared this passion also with his mentor, John Elkeld, which is that the legal system in America, the judicial system and the penal system, they are broken. And in the 1870s, Elkeld wrote a very famous little book about how the machinery that throws people in jail and forgets them leads to social disaster. And Darrow believed that as well, that Darrow published a little book about crime and punishment, that why is it that our first instinct is to, you know, apprehend and then destroy, when maybe, possibly, what we could do is apprehend and rehabilitate? He did believe that there were some people who needed to be separated from the rest of us, that were too dangerous to live in the general population of Americans, but that was a very small number. And in fact, he kept a very nice correspondence, and you can read this in the papers of Clarence Darrow at the Library of Congress, with one of the boys, Nathan Leopold, who is eventually released and lives what you might consider a kind of normal life. But Darrow was very interested in not only saving these boys from the death penalty, but also helping them with their demons and trying to get them reintroduced into society.
Mm. The other thing that maybe you might talk a little bit about was the caller mentioned his impassioned defense of the men. And here was something that Darrow was really famous for as a speaker. He could speak for hours. His closing arguments could sometimes run for hours.
Yes, and run for days. And it was a different age, in an age when Americans could listen to longer pieces. I think we've lost that ability a little bit today. But Darrow it's hard to describe the magnetism of Clarence Darrow, but when he spoke, people wanted to listen, and his closing statements could be 8, 12 hours long over several days, and they were impassioned. And what often happened in the Leopold and Loeb case, happened in the Oshkosh Woodworkers case of 1898, and all these other great defenses, is that they were reprinted and sold, and they did very well. And they become a kind of a heritage that Americans can draw upon about the struggles for liberty and freedom in this country.
Hmm. Are there recordings of Darrow?
I've only found one, and it's on the History Channel. And you can go there online and listen to Darrow speak about crime and punishment. That little book I referenced was also turned into a lecture, and someone taped it. And it's on the Internet for you to listen to. He's an old man when he's talking. His voice sounds a little bit like cement being mixed. It's kind of gravelly. But you get the force of it. And Darrow could speak very loudly and forcefully and then bring his voice down to a whisper, which forced the jurors to lean forward. And then at the end, he would have the entire courtroom crying, judge, bailiff, jurors, witnesses. Everyone would be crying. He would be crying. And when that happened, he knew he had won the case.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to imagine people being persuaded or responding to that kind of emotionalism today.
Right. In Los Angeles, he was accused of trying to hypnotize the jury and all the spectators and witnesses. He had that kind of attraction, that kind of charisma. He was a tall man, piercing blue eyes. He drew attention to him. And he also was a very gifted orator in an age when there were many gifted orators, but a very gifted orator. And he could keep attention like Abraham Lincoln could keep attention for people. They would listen to him as long as he would speak.
We have mentioned some of his later cases and the fact that after his involvement with the L.A. Times bombing case, he really was not involved in labor after that point.
But there were a couple cases. There's one in Wisconsin, and I say somewhat ironically, these were cases where unionists were brought up on charges of dynamiting things, and so he knew how to make those defenses. But and then there are a number of cases in northern Michigan that he defended.
The thing I'm thinking about is particularly, as you say, that near the end of his career, he really concentrated mostly on a couple of things. And one is his fight against capital punishment.
Yep.
And another is civil rights, and some of his cases in the 20s do reflect that. Are there other things that you can point to, particularly when that do involve civil rights issues?
Sure, and they're often very small cases that you might overlook because they didn't have the kind of media footprint that the Detroit, Ashi, and Suisse home invasion case did. But another way, too, that you can come at this issue of civil rights is in the 1920s, Darrow testified on various bills and committees before Congress to abolish the death penalty in the United States. And Darrow made it very clear that one of the things that bothered him the most about the death penalty was that disproportionately African Americans were involved. And so the abolition of the death penalty for him was also a civil rights issue, whereby that there was a small group of Americans who were being preyed upon by a larger society, and Darrow wanted that stopped. But there's also a case in Northern Illinois, the Isaac Bond case. Isaac Bond was a janitor who was accused of murdering a nurse. And it's very clear that the local civil rights organizations came to Darrow. Darrow took the case pro bono, and it was an all-white jury. Bond was sentenced to life in prison. That might have just been the end of it, but Darrow pro bono took the appeals case and tried for years to get him to be released through the parole process. Eventually, Mr. Bond dies of tuberculosis in jail. But Darrow, once again, would take on a kind of case. He would absorb the emotion of the case as if his life depended on it. Hmm. There are little cases and big cases that he did that in.
He was, I guess, one of the things that I'm struck by, and now as I have learned some things about Darrow, is that he was a real Midwesterner. He was born in Ohio. He went to school at University of Michigan. That's where he got his law degree. And, of course, then had these ties to Illinois and Illinois politics and lived in Chicago. Were there in ways in which you think that particularly being a Midwesterner emerges in his character or shaped his interests?
Yeah, I'm hesitant to do that and make those regional stereotypes. But one thing I can say about Midwesterners, they tend to be very tolerant, and you can see this in his life in Ohio. His dad was the village infidel, but yet they sort of tolerated him in a way that, well, he's our infidel. And Darrow had an outlook on life in which he tried to, the best he could, make accommodations for all sorts of ways of thinking, politically liberal, radical, conservative, and yet have a relationship with these people. And it allows him to both be the lawyer that defends the L.A. bombing trial suspects and the lawyer for the Chicago Northwest Railroad. He's a very tolerant guy, and I think that is a kind of Midwesternism at an age when the Midwest wasn't very well populated, and there often you had to put up with your neighbors in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. I guess I also find myself coming back to this idea that he was a very complex man. He could be very contradictory, or it would appear to be contradictory, and that he was really very hard to pin down. And he definitely had his own set of principles that he brought to whatever particular situation or issue, so that he could seem to be sort of on one side of things, but then he could seem to be on the other side of the things. So again, that what makes it possible. So he could have been a labor lawyer, or he could have been a corporate lawyer, or that he could have been a pacifist, and at the same time he supported the United States being involved in World War I, and that he was on the left politically, but he had his differences with the New Deal. I mean, it sounds like he's a man. It's very difficult to put in one kind of category.
He's a on the one hand, but on the other hand kind of guy.
Yeah.
It does make it very difficult, and it also makes it difficult to show how he develops his thought over time. I think then this is why politics is a good framework for Darrow, because the question I think he asked himself is the same one John Elkill would have asked himself in any situation. Politically, what's your goal, and how can I use where I am, what I'm doing, to get to that goal? And so if you see him like that as sort of an acolyte of John Elkill, I think it reveals a little bit of something of his character. which is the fights he had were largely political fights. And that said, he internalized those cases, and it's very important to remember that because he's not just using people to get ahead in politics, but he used these moments to make a larger political statement.
Yeah, I think that you just as a way of finishing up, and I think in the conclusion here, you write something really nice here that for five decades, an amazingly long time in American politics, he, that is Darrow, he fought to expand liberties, rights, and freedoms so that the average people could have a fair chance of living the American dream. You think of that time and the challenges of that time and where we are right now. So then if one asks the question, well, why should we know about this man? Why is it not good that he's kind of been forgotten? Well, maybe it's because we should pay attention to how over time problems, maybe they don't change.
No, our struggles are his struggles. And he would be very interested in our time. And the rollback, for example, on collective bargaining, which was the thing that ended that class war that he lived through. And people died needlessly in that class war. And he would wonder what we were thinking by eliminating those mechanisms in society where you can get fair resolutions for these larger fights. And he would also wonder very much about certain Supreme Court decisions recently. I think you're going to have a nice show on one of them.
Yes,
Darrow
indeed.
Would be listening to that show, because here you have a group of workers who can get no relief from the Supreme Court. Darrow had been there. He was there in 1894. He went to the Supreme Court for Eugene Debs, and they turned him away with a flick of the wrist. Darrow would understand what average people are going through, and he would worry, I think, that if the legal and political systems don't afford a way for average people to find their own interests, then there are other ways. And that's, I have to tell you, that's pretty scary stuff. Yeah.
Our guest, Andrew Kirsten, is a professor of history in the Department of Democracy and Justice Studies at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and is also author of the new book, Clarence Darrow, American Iconoclast. Helen Wang is the publisher. Professor Kirsten, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives from a little earlier this year. We hope to reschedule the show that we were going to do, a conversation with journalist-novelist Siddhartha Deb about his book, The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of India. And you can listen to a lot of past programs by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, celebrating 26 years of fair trade. 10,000 Villages creates opportunities for artisans in developing countries to earn income by bringing their products and stories to our markets through long-term fair trading relationships. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Charleston Community Theater, presenting Life Times 3 this Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Tarbell Arts Center in Charleston. Seating is limited. Reservations can be made at 581-2787 or online at charlestoncommunitytheater.org.
We will take a break, as we usually do here. In the next hour, we will take calls for computer questions, something we do every month on the show. Celeste Quinn will be the host, and her guests will be Debbie Fleiger and Jim Eyrick, both from the U of I. Debbie works for Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services, and Jim works for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. So whether you're looking for a new computer, you have questions about online security, you need some troubleshooting advice, they will be happy to help. That is in hour number two. First, though, we'll take our break. Break for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session all across the commodities floor. Prices are higher. Does seem, though, as soybeans may be one of the leading factors here as we're trading into the second half of this day. Many traders up on the floor saying today that they are covering short positions because they believe that the market is technically oversold. Well, let's go ahead and look at some particulars. And we'll begin in Kansas City, where double digits are the order of the day for the wheat market. The December wheat contract at 725 up 12, while the May is at 748 and 3 quarters up 11 and a half. Wheat futures at the Chicago Board of Trade, the December contract, the lead month, the highest for a price increase at